Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact.
Ignoring the climate is violence. You know, it's violence to these communities that actually don't, that have no footprint, you know, but take the brunt of all of this, kind of abuse, you know. So we're still in a kind of violent capacity. We're still in a violent world, you know, where wealthy countries, countries with power, absolutely decimate and devastate communities. They don't do it with weapons anymore. They weaponize the climate to do it. And I think that we're still in this conversation.
My guest today is Chiwetel Ejiofor, Oscar-nominated and BAFTA-winning actor, director, and writer. Chiwetel has a breadth of critically acclaimed work across stage and screen. In 2014, he starred as Solomon Northrup in Steve McQueen's Oscar-winning film, 12 Years a Slave, which gained him Oscar, Golden Globe, and Screen Actor Guild nominations and won him a Best Actor BAFTA. Earlier this year, his directorial debut, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, launched on Netflix. He's an active supporter of Brightland Academy, a school in southeast Nigeria, founded by his mother, Dr. Obiajulu Ejiofor. Along with contributing to a scholarship in memory of his father, Chiwetel partners with the Gianco Foundation to provide Brightland with computers, electronic whiteboards, sports facilities, and a future center for music and the dramatic arts. He's a recipient of the Pencils of Promise Activist Award, and in 2015 was awarded a CBE for services to drama. Chiwetel, welcome.
Hi.
It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about your... Everyone has a philanthropic origin story. So what made you decide to get involved with Brightland, with education, with the work that you do in Nigeria? Why do it as opposed to not do it?
I think for me, it was something that was part of the way that I grew up, really, and the way that I was raised. You know, as you mentioned, Brightland Academy is founded by my mother, and her passion for education was something obviously that I understood firsthand, you know, when I was growing up, and also, you know, because of the experiences that she had when she was growing up and during the Biafran War, when she was in her early teenage years, and the stress and pressure that was put under that area of Nigeria at the time, and so what she witnessed there and the way that education ultimately helped her kind of escape not only the sort of overall circumstances slightly post-war, but also the kind of gendered specific circumstances that that she could have been sort of led into. And that was actually also through credit to my grandparents as well, who really emphasized her education, women's education, the daughter's education, at that time. And so, and this sort of allowed for a whole, you know, sort of sequence of circumstances that in terms of empowerment, in terms of education, in terms of moving, in terms of becoming a pharmacist, and my father was a doctor. And so so all of that origin, all of that's kind of beginning, made me think a lot about education as I was growing up. And so when my mother wanted to start the academy, the Brightland Academy, you know, I was just very excited about that as a prospect of bringing that, you know, energy back to Enugu, to southeastern Nigeria, as well as trying to feature education and ideas around education in a lot of my work broadly, you know. And so I think that if I was to say that where that sort of origin came from, I think it's from family.
And Brightland, tell us a little bit about what it does, what it sets out to do, how far along on its journey it is.
So Brightland is a school that, you know, has about, you know, I mean, it has sort of about 300 students now. We are expanding that and finishing the build of the secondary school as well. And so the idea behind it was to create a space, to create a school as a primary and secondary school education in Nigeria that would have a sort of, that kids would have access to a world-class education with all of these, several scholarships inbuilt into the structure of it, into the system of it, to give students who had, all of these, all of this potential, all of these skills, an avenue, not just to get a good education, but to actually get a sort of world-class education in all of the facets of that. It just became important, I think, for all of us to make sure that there was, in that community, an absolute avenue for that. As we all know, and as is often discussed, that this, the ideas of potential are all over the world, and opportunity not so much. And so trying to find ways, and in large ways and small ways, of making sure that people have access if they're skilled and if they are dedicated, if they're, and they can be encouraged to explore their talents, to do that. And so we wanted to do something that wasn't just was obviously centered on education. A very important part of it was education, but also to make sure that we had all of these up-to-date sports facilities, and then to create this drama center and music center, and so to have artistically a very three-dimensional approach to the work and to the studies there.
How do you go about deciding who gets into a school like this? Because there must be an infinite number of applicants. The potential has to far exceed the available slots, and it has to just be truly transformative of people's lives. How do you make those agonizing choices?
Yeah, well, it's complicated, and I think that you have to do it on a kind of case by case basis, and which is why one of the reasons why we also partnered with David Ayelowo and his school in the north of Nigeria, which is very specifically for girls' empowerment and girls' education, and so that there would be scholarship students, through his foundation that would also come to Brightland. And so I think we look at that in a way that is slightly, holistic and of what the sort of general needs are. Of course, there's the focus on just the student's potential and what they can bring and what they're able to achieve. And then wider than that, in the sort of selective process, it comes down to those kinds of ideas. What are the wider implications of the choices that you make, and making sure that features in the decision making.
So setting up a school like this in this particular setting and context is no easy thing, and it sounds, wonderful, but there must be dozens of hard and difficult things in the actual execution. And in the show, we try and explore the hard parts of achieving social impact. So tell us something that was just unexpectedly difficult that you had to struggle your way through, that's just been hard, perhaps you overcome, perhaps you're still struggling with. Tell us a hard real life story, not just a fairy tale story.
Yeah, I mean, the real sort of basis of all of it is the dedication of my mother, to create it. And I have seen through her and through what she has been struggling with, it's just kind of dealing with personnel and dealing with the kind of bureaucracy of setting up something like this, of dealing with a sort of institution and all of the things that, and all the energies that come at you as you try to battle your way through it. And for her, because she grew up in Nigeria, that she spent her youth in Nigeria, she's been able to balance some of those challenges of finding the people. The key thing is to find the people that you can really trust, who can really do the work on the ground and really assist with that work, especially when you're not there all the time, And finding that, and where I've been able to help is to try and bring in partnership from overseas, and this is where GeneCo were incredibly helpful with sort of trying to find other channels to kind of bring in energy, obviously sort of help finance things, and to bring in different ideas, different approaches, so that we can kind of widen the development of the school and the experience for the students in the best possible way. So I think it's a combination of things. I think it's sort of one of those things, it's all challenging. If you're trying to do something in the scale and in the way that we're trying to do it, which is not just set up something, sort of, you know, dust your hands off and then hop on a plane, you know, but really be there working with students, working with faculty, you know, trying to be in part of the kind of organic process so that people have a real total holistic experience at the school, that they come out equipped to deal with all sorts of things, and a life that might center in Nigeria, might center overseas. And so all of those things require, you know, sustained effort. And I think it's that. It's committing to something that you know is going to be a kind of a lifelong project. And that's when I think choosing what you're doing becomes a very deeply selective process, you know, because for me, and like I say, you know, this is partly because it's connected to my family, but to me, it's sort of that thing of knowing that you are deeply rooted, deeply connected to something, that you're there for the long haul, that you're there to see it through all its machinations, you're there to grow it as well, perhaps even generationally, and to really be part of the institution of it, you know, for good. And I think that you take on then all of the different day-to-day or year-to-year complications. You bring in those alliances and friendships and that you can in order to pursue the goals of that as effectively as you can. And, you know, we're lucky enough to have a lot of people there that really are also deeply passionate about it, who see the potential of the school, who understand what it's doing and what it can do, and what it continues to do. And are very, you know, very excited about it.
So you mentioned earlier that you're very interested and committed to education as a sphere of social change, and your directorial debut, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, is a remarkable story about a young man, or a boy almost, who by some measures or some definition had very little education but did something that was quite remarkable, almost unprecedented. Tell us that story in brief.
Yeah, so the story of The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind is the story of William Kamkwamba. And he, when he was in his early teens, went through, you know, the terrible circumstances of the famine in Malawi, which was from about 2000 to 2001, the failed harvest, and the kind of the systemic sort of failures that happened around that time, and truly what was, I think, to this day, the last purely economic famine. That is, that the price of grain just went beyond the reach of the farmers. You know, it wasn't that there wasn't grain in the country. You know, some of the grain had been shipped out, but there was grain in the country. There was grain around. It was reduced, and the prices went up, you know, and they went up beyond that reach. And there was nothing in the international community. You know, there were a lot of systemic issues as well. There were a lot of failures. There were a lot of the advice had been given that, you know, in terms of the grain, that it should be sold. A lot of the excess grain was sold to Mozambique from Malawi. And so, and that was under the advice of the International Monetary Fund, and so and the World Bank was involved as well. And so all of these choices were made, and all these decisions, some of them local, some of them international, the fairly sort of neoliberal kind of ideas. And as a result, this community was sort of left to sort of fend for itself with this incredibly overpriced grain. And so William Kamkwamba was at school at the time in the village of Wimbe in the Kasungu region. They were being affected. He was pulled out of school in order to save money, you know, by his parents. Secondary school isn't free in Malawi. And so he started the process of sneaking into the school to try to try and get an education, essentially. And on one of these trips, he found, in the library, he found a book called Using Energy, which is an American textbook, and on the front of it was a windmill, and so this gave him the idea that he could generate power, and that power could be utilized to irrigate land, and so, you know, that in broad terms, that's the story of the context of the film. He wrote the book about his experiences in that time. I read that book when it came out in 2009, 2010. I was in Los Angeles at the time. And I was profoundly moved by it. I was moved by him, by his, you know, his tenacity, his pursuit for an education, his pursuit for solutions, for, you know, this kind of a sort of solution-oriented understanding. And I was, you know, I was moved by how the book touched on all of these different areas of our world and our relationship to things internationally, how it touched on all of those. The economic touch points. Of course, the windmill touches on the climate and sustainability and how all of those, you know, all of those things sort of feed into each other. And here was a young boy who had a capacity to look past those problems, those immediate problems, and center in on a solution. And so I began the process of adapting the book and not really knowing, you know, how it was going to go or, you know, but I just felt very strongly that it was a film that I wanted to try to get out into the world.
And it's been released on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I was saying earlier that I was at the TED conference in Arusha where William gave the kind of first talk about that experience. And I too got goosebumps sitting in that audience hearing this remarkable story of courage and ingenuity and tenacity and how a community of people, if wrapped around him, could help him soar to greater heights. And you're obviously doing that right now. Where is he? What is he doing?
Well, you know, William Kamkwamba's story continues in this, you know, he's such a remarkable and, you know, sort of wonderful person. So he, you know, he went to Dartmouth, you know, to continue his education. And then he started working in Carolina, in North Carolina, I think. And that was with, you know, with working with companies to bring internet access to places in the world that didn't have internet access or had very limited internet access. And so he was working within that context and then started to develop this idea about about building a center in Lilongwe, the capital of Malawi, where people would come into that center, young people, and they would talk about the problems that they identify in their communities and what the solutions they think should be brought to these places are, to specifically where they are, to specifically their own communities. And then he would work with them to sort of actualize and realize those ideas, you know. So much in the same way that he, as a young person, was able to identify very specifically what was needed and then went about finding a solution to that. He feels that empowering young people in that context and then supporting them in that way is the way to actually make some proper positive empowered change in those communities. I happen to absolutely agree with him that is entirely the way to do it, you know. So, you know, with the film as well, you know, we're working with him to realize that, and he's making progress with that, and that's, you know, where he is now. And so I'm sort of getting updates as to where that's going and fitting in where I can, like how to help and that's working, you know. And I think if that's one of the lasting legacies of the film, I think that's a great thing. I think it is about empowerment, mostly, actually. It's about empowerment and education, but it's also about trust, you know. It's about trusting people to trusting what they say, understanding that they have insight into these situations. And really, you know, when I remember when I first traveled to Malawi, having read the book and even having written a draft of the book, and nothing still prepared me of traveling along the road, leaving Kasungu, going towards Wimbe, and turning a corner and seeing William's windmill, you know, nothing else around, and just a windmill like in the middle of nowhere, you know, surrounded by, you know, acres and acres and acres of land, rolling land. And I really, for the first time, understood the size of his achievement, you know, and what it means to empower young people.
the number of boys or girls who go from Wimbe and Malawi to Dartmouth is a vanishingly small number, and is a true testament to his courage and his ingenuity. But speaking of which, there's something about a young Malawian boy going to the United States and going to Dartmouth that makes me think about 12 Years a Slave. Mm. And the paradox that is the United States, a place that is filled with opportunity but has a tremendous legacy, an unaddressed and unresolved legacy of race and racism, and perhaps all the more poignant now, given the state of the presidency. So tell me a little bit about that film, because it was an incredible professional accomplishment of yours, but one which touches on, I think, the great unresolved wound that still seeps in the United States.
Well, yes. I mean, it's not just the United States, you know. It's a global issue. You know, this history, this kind of this sort of Western violence around the world is unresolved. And it is something that I think is not only unresolved, but it's not going anywhere, you know. Ignoring the climate is violence. You know, it's violence to these communities that actually don't, but have no footprint, you know, but take the brunt of all of this, kind of abuse, you know. So we're still in a kind of violent capacity. We're still in a violent world, you know, where wealthy countries, countries with power, absolutely decimate and devastate communities. They don't do it with weapons anymore. They weaponize the climate to do it. And I think that we're still in this conversation. You know, we're still, and in fact, it's a conversation that in some ways is getting worse. You know, and the consequences are worse. The consequences could potentially be worse than anything that's come before. And so. So I feel like we are in a state where there just has to be lines drawn, you know, where people have to be really engaged, and I think people are. I mean, I think there's growing numbers of people who are engaged. I think they're, you know, engaged because not only do they recognize how terrible the circumstances, but they also recognize that, you know, in their own interests of self-preservation, you know, that they need to get involved at a certain point. And so, you know, you hope with a film like 12 Years a Slave, you hope that you shine a light on some of the injustices that have happened. You can speak to how those injustices still have, have impact in the world that we live in today. But also, you know, it's a way of also looking at the things that we're not looking at, you know, that the ideas that we still live in all of these injustices, and there are different ways, newly created ways of injustice and violence in our world.
How do you strike the balance between what is undeniably a political seam that runs through your work and what you're interested in and passionate about and your connections back to your motherland, and an entire parallel universe of Hollywood and celebrity and Vanity Fair parties and the things that come with, you know, quite richly deserved, you know, fame, which has arisen from your work. How does that juxtaposition work out for you?
Well, it turns out I actually happen to spend very little time at Vanity Fair parties and in that that side of the kind of Hollywood machine. I mean, not necessarily through choice. I just haven't. It's not something that I've, you know, dived into feet first, particularly. So I don't see a lot of that, you know, in a way. And even when I lived in Los Angeles, I just didn't. I wasn't as excited about that side of it all, and the engagement of that. But I did recognize that it was. That, you know, making films and talking about films in this way is, and, you know, look, not every film has to be, you know, centered around huge and important issues. You know, it is, part of it is, of course, about entertaining and engaging and entertaining people and also artistic expression, you know, which I love. And so there's all of that. And I felt like that has actually taken up the majority of my time. And Hollywood and Los Angeles, you know, is able to facilitate a lot of those things. And of course, you know, within the context of that, you can facilitate all of these other conversations and all of this other engagement. There are enough people who are engaged with all of these things for it to matter in terms of entertainment, you know, in terms of entertainment as a sort of as an umbrella term. And so, you know, Hollywood can encompass all of those things. And I'm happy for that. You know, I'm happy for all of the celebrity parties and the kind of and all of the sort of frivolity of it, if you like. Because I think underneath a lot of that, you know, can be very serious, very dynamic engagement. And I think it allows people to find their way into those conversations, as in the general public, into those conversations and into that space in a way that isn't necessarily sort of didactic or sort of elitist in a way, which is what some of the dangers are or can be.
So part of what we try and do on the show is give particularly young people who are thinking about starting their lives and their careers and are wanting to lead lives of meaning and of purpose and of social impact, advice as to the pathways they might take. And if there's a group of people out there who are interested in the performing arts and are interested in artistic expression, but also want to achieve impact in the way you undoubtedly have, what's your advice to them?
Well, I think it's about finding your passion, you know, and that I think it's I think that's true artistically, but I think it's also true in terms of your social impact. I think the thing about it is that you've got to find things or think about things that you really do care about and that you really are going to be involved in forever. Essentially. And that, because I think you need that kind of depth of commitment to something to really push through it. I feel that it's not, you know, for a lot of people, I think that sometimes it can be, and this is not a criticism particularly, because I think that there are different ways of coming to this whole thing. But for some people, you know, that there's an idea of becoming famous, becoming a celebrity, and then taking on a couple of projects and sort of pet projects that are part of that, and although that's fine, you know, I think it can be more direct and more engaged and more passionate if the work in a way has been done beforehand. That's just in my experience. People who, before they were celebrities, before they were, you know, when they were at drama school, when they were starting out, when they were thinking about what they were going to do, maybe they weren't going to go into the arts at all, already cared about certain issues, had already isolated the things that I feel are not, that are unjust in the world that I see and why they're unjust and what the problems are and how I might be able to help in that conversation, how I might be able to engage. And those people who then go into the arts and then maybe become successful, who have already established that sort of identity, I think can be incredibly impactful.
Everything that I've experienced as my life as a human rights lawyer and, you know, the struggle against apartheid in South Africa relied on people with a tremendous amount of profile and integrity to come to our assistance at crucial moments. So I wholeheartedly endorse that view. Chiwetel Ejiofor, for everything that you've done on the screen, but much more importantly, for everything you've done off it and elsewhere. Thank you so much for joining us on Conduit Conversations.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.